First of all, this is my entire PowerPoint presentation. My technical people were not available to work on this. As my 13-year-old daughter said, she had a dance and horseback riding, and she was not doing anything for free. It's killed that. So that's the whole thing. So turn the lights on. Right now, I'm sure I understand that. My job here is to talk a little bit about the actual implementation of conservation programs. And really what I want to do is go through kind of why this is worth paying any attention to at all, what are some of the problems that we run into basically, what has been a common set of elements where EQIP has actually worked for growers. And I'll talk a little bit, as Ed mentioned, about what might be happening, what's worth doing in the future for conservation programs. First of all, my organization is the Center for Ag Partnerships. We're in Asheville, North Carolina. If you're interested in Asheville, North Carolina, it's not as nice as they say. You won't like living there. Secondly, I'm really serious. my organization has been working the last 5 years primarily figuring out ways to get people that haven't been involved in EQIP into EQIP programs. We've now worked in 11 states on more than a dozen crops, and it's been a relatively large effort. We have raised, our projects have entailed about $1.5 million, a third of which has really come from land grants and grower groups, and most of that money's come from EPA and from private foundations. Let me also say I'm going to talk specifically about EQIP. It's only one of the many programs that NRCS happens to offer every year. It's the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. It's also the largest program. I'm also going to talk, and I think most of us have been talking, primarily about specialty crops. But more broadly, we're talking about people who have never been involved in conservation programs before. And most specialty crop producers have never gotten federal funding for really much of anything beyond the research and extension programs. Here's why this really matters, as far as why EQIP really matters. USDA and the university spend an enormous amount of money every year on research, both basic and applied research. If you look at the continuum from research over here to implementation, you've got various steps in implementing an IPM program, from applied research, demonstration, education. When you get down to the implementation point in all of our projects, and I'm sure for most of the projects which I have been involved in, the initial adoption of new IPM practices costs the grower something more. Costs more money, costs more management time, but invariably there's a cost associated with the adoption of these new practices. And it's a cost that in most cases the grower doesn't recoup. We don't raise the price of a bushel of apples because we went out and did mating disruption or something like that. So what EQIP provides is an opportunity to give the grower something to help them deal with the financial disincentive for adopting a new practice. So it's really the piece over the last several years, last decades, that has not been in the mix, that really provides us the way to capitalize on all that investment that we put in research to actually get something done on the ground. The other reason that EQIP matters is EQIP right now is larger, the single program in NRCS is larger than the entire research budget at USDA by a couple hundred thousand dollars. If the Farm Bill, as construed currently in the House version, passes, which is totally something different, it'll be twice, more than twice as large as the research budget for the entire USDA, ARS, CSRES, extension, everything. So in terms of where we're investing our money, this is where the federal government, Congress, has decided to invest more and more money over time. It's critically important for us. Let me say basically, when Mike has talked about a number of places where EQIP has been used and where conservation programs have been involved, there are basically two problems. One is knowledge, the other is resources. And you wouldn't think if you had $5 billion, you'd have any resource issues, but let me show you there. First of all, well, again, since we're talking about growers who have never used federal conservation programs, and we're talking about new practices like IPM, there's a huge knowledge gap here. With no disrespect to the great people who work at NRCS, virtually none of them could tell you what biofix is, couldn't tell you what a phenological model is, couldn't help you put together a spray program, and even the CCAs who typically work, certified crop advisors, who work with NRCS, are not qualified to do pest management programs. So NRCS has not typically had the kind of technical expertise to implement pest management programs for tree food, vegetables, for special crops in general. At the same time, growers know nothing about these programs. I went to see a grower who said he'd never used NRCS programs, didn't have a contract or anything, and I said, so what are you doing? He says, a big sweet potato grower in East Smith County. He said, well, let me show you this book. So he shows me this book, which is basically his conservation security program plan. He had gotten about $200,000 from the federal government. He didn't know it came from the federal government. He didn't know that it was a particular program. All he knew was that he's doing something smart on his farm, and somebody would come in and help him get into the program. He's the exception. Most of our growers don't know what the NRCS office is. They think it's the NCIS office or the ASCS office. They don't even know what it is. Don't know how to apply to the programs. Most of the information that goes out from NRCS, because they've never worked with specialty crop growers in a lot of states, doesn't even go out to specialty crop growers. And most of our growers, our extension agents that work with them, don't know much about the programs. So there's a huge gap, even though there's a huge opportunity here. Secondly, most of the people in extension and land grants don't know much about these programs. You're looking at the exception to the rule here in the people in this room. We had a big meeting in Wilmington, North Carolina with about 40 or 50 strawberry growers where we talked about a new practice that had been implemented for methylbromide alternatives in strawberry and vegetable production. About 40 growers there, all of them said, this would be great. We'd love to use this program. And so I said, where do you guys get your information about new programs? We get them from extension. Six extension agents in the back of the room, smart people, there's nothing wrong with them. I said, hey, they're an extension, that's a separate thing. But these are smart people in real life. They, I asked all of them if they knew anything about these programs. They knew nothing. So the usual mechanism by which growers learn about these programs isn't available in most cases. So there's a huge knowledge gap. It's not only a gap in basic knowledge, there's also a gap in working relationships, even though you've heard of some of the exceptions. On the resource side, NRCS gets roughly $5 billion for EQIP alone in the last farm bill. NRCS got not one single additional employee. So basically, they got a huge reservoir of gasoline and nobody drives the vehicle. There has been virtually no more money for outreach, for conservation planning, for additional program services, or for technical assistance. So somehow, NRCS is supposed to deliver $5 billion worth of programs with no additional resources. That's meant that NRCS has had to deal with the people they knew and take extra time to deal with growers that have never been in the door. And that's a huge problem. There are enormous transaction costs for the growers to get to know these programs and for NRCS to get to have working relationships with the growers, with the extension agents, and getting a little bit up to speed on the technical aspects of something like IPM. So that's just the way things are. That's an enormous problem. There's a real mismatch right now between the resources that are available for this program and our actual ability to deliver the programs to people who have never been in the programs before. Having said that, there, as Mike has mentioned, as Ed mentioned, there are exceptions to the rule. And those exceptions to the rule have some very, very basic things in common. Where growers have succeeded in getting involved in conservation programs, in each case, the grower groups have decided to get very involved in making it possible. And in many cases, for example, in Michigan a few years ago, the head of the Asparagus Growers Association said, I'm going to encourage my growers to apply to this program, even though I know most of them are going to get turned down. Because we've got this little catch-22. We don't apply for the growers that don't apply for the programs. NRCS never meets these guys. Our growers never understand the programs. And there seems to be no demand on the grower side. So when the grower groups have gotten involved, it's been very helpful. It's also been helpful because it's, with all due respect, you get a bunch of entomologists coming into the room and say, hey, we want to do some entomology. Can you have some more federal money? Big deal. With all due respect to entomologists, that's not what NRCS is out there for. NRCS is out there to deliver, NRCS is out there to deliver programs to growers so they can conserve natural resources. So growers are both a constituency and within a small political constituency for these programs. Their support and their interest in this is absolutely essential. Secondly, you need to have the technical expertise for IPM available. Whether it's the land grant people, or it's people like Barry, Will, or other consultants involved, if you don't have the science already lined up, it's going to be really hard to push this program through. It's going to be hard to give NRCS good information. It's going to be hard to actually explain these programs to the growers. The third piece has been the support of the state office and important people in the state office. In California, we have good working relationship with folks there. In North Carolina, Mike's talking about getting married and stuff like that. But I love those guys. They're great guys to work with. So the state office matters a lot because the program specifications really make a difference into how easily these programs are adaptable for growers. The other thing is it's absolutely essential, if you're going to make this work, to have at least one district conservationist, one person at the county level who's willing to work with these growers and put in the extra time. Well, you know this, if you don't have that, these programs don't happen. So there gotta be people out there willing to do some additional work. The other piece that's true in all of these are extremely labor-intensive efforts. You have to have somebody out there who's really going to take the time to help growers go through the application process, whether it's the work that Barry did with a lot of his growers. You need somebody like Dave Bittner in Pennsylvania who's willing to talk to the growers when they have questions, to help them work through the problems. When the district conservationist doesn't understand what in the world the grower's doing, there always has to be an awful lot of follow-up, especially at the beginning of a new program. Once these programs get up and running, it's fine. But there's an enormous investment of time and energy in making these programs work. If you don't have it, it doesn't happen. The good news about all of this is that the programs are really quite adaptable. The standards are written in such a way that you can do a lot of things. And just in the last year, we've done everything from work with small hog operators raising hogs outdoors in North Carolina, to establishing work with organic farmers, to establish grain production in eastern North Carolina, to working with peach growers in Georgia to implement mating disruption, and finally to adding to our state EQIP program practices to mitigate the impacts of methyl bromide, incentives for methyl bromide and for the use of impermeable tarping. So the program has an enormously broad applicability in terms of the types of resource concerns it can address. But the truth of the matter is that all of these require those seven elements to succeed at the local level. Okay. Huge potential, adaptable programs, but what we still have is a series of relatively isolated incidents. This IPM is not available in every state. For example, this year, for the first time, Virginia is making its first payments under the 595 standard in its history. Virginia is a big specialty crop state. So the question is, how do we take what we've learned in these individual situations and make it more broadly available? There's been a lot of talk about the Farm Bill. Quite frankly, the Farm Bill is not the place, and Jonathan may have a different perspective on this, Farm Bill is not the place to write language about specific practices like IPM. Farm Bill is the place to talk about broad resource concerns and what are the mechanisms necessary so that we can address those resource concerns. And so I think in terms of what the Farm Bill can do, and actually what at least both the House and Senate versions of the Farm Bill currently have, and the House has a version of the Farm Bill, and the Senate has some ideas about a version of the Farm Bill. At least the Ag Committee does anyways. There's several things that can be done over the next year that are at least in the hopper now as far as legislative language. One is, and Michael alluded to this, is to establish some national attention at the headquarters level to look and see not whether IPM is being implemented, but what are the needs of specialty crop growers and other growers who've never been involved in conservation programs can be addressed effectively by not only our programs, but also the mechanisms that we have in place. That provides both an equity of treatment and equity of opportunity for grower groups of a whole range of crops, but it also opens up an enormous constituency of people who can increase resource conservation because they're in management-intensive crops. If you're going to start conserving resources in the United States, You would probably look for those people who are already the best managers and the most comprehensive managers of crops if you wanted to get the quickest return for your dollar. And so there needs to be attention at the headquarters level to address the needs of specialty crop growers, which in turn will address IBM issues. Secondly, we need to address alternative ways of delivering these programs to farmers. With all due respect to NRCS, Congress and the Office of Management and Budget are not likely to give you any new employees. It's just the way it is. And no one's going to stump get out unless it's for the defense budget. Nobody's going to say, my promise to you as my constituents is to increase the number of government employees you deal with every day. No one's going to do it, even if it's necessary. So there need to be alternative ways of delivering education, outreach, and technical assistance to make these programs available to growers. And there are ways of doing that, both through cooperative agreements, through contribution agreements, and through other arrangements with universities, with NGOs, and with even conservation districts and other state agencies. In North Carolina, all of our wildlife programs are delivered through a cooperative agreement with the State Wildlife Agency and NRCS. Thirdly, there needs to be funding for these education efforts. If Extension and organizations like mine are going to be able to do the kind of education necessary for growers to use these programs, there has to be money out there. There has to be money for technical assistance, obviously. Programs like the Conservation Innovation Grants need to be directed towards the needs of outreach and education for specialty crop producers. The special projects that are authorized in the Farm Bill need to be oriented again with a priority for working with specialty crop growers and other people that are in these programs. The sources for those money are obviously NRCS through Farm Bill programs, EPA through a strategic ag initiative has been very helpful. And actually the place that we need the most investment right now in terms of helping extension agents understand these programs and be more effective in working with growers is CSREES. And at the moment, there is no program in CSREES dedicated to providing funds for this set of issues. And that's a needed improvement. What we can do with that funding is do two things. One is take the existing models that we've already noted and provide additional funding so it can be brought to other states. And secondly, what I think we can do is provide an ongoing program for extension agents. So if they want to learn about these programs, they can provide that information back to the growers. There's been a lot of talk about training NRCS people. Is anybody here besides Mark and Ray who are from NRCS? You don't know how much these people train each other. They are always in training. If you keep them on the phone, they're in training or out in the field. One or two. Nothing in between. So it's not necessary. I'm sorry. You guys just maybe don't learn quickly. I just don't know what it is.
It could be that's the only story we're telling you.
Yeah. Training a keg. I mean, they all go together. It's not necessary for NRCS people to be experts at IPM. We have experts in IPM. We have a lot of wonderful experts in IPM. What we need is for NRCS to have access to those people and for our people who are experts in IPM and who work with growers, county agents, to know enough about the programs to make them available easily to our growers. So I'm trying to sit and get some training. Let me just say kind of finally here, I think it's important to realize again the enormous potential that these programs have for both specialty crop growers, for resource conservation, and for IPM. But in the end, NRCS programs are not going to be about IPM. They're going to be about delivering resource conservation incentives to farmers to do smart things on their farms. If I were going to provide any kind of advice, and I'm not loath to people in IPM, I think it's absolutely essential that IPM do what it really can do. It goes back to, you know, when Larry Hall was using one of the orchards I managed to find tufted apple bed moth because there was so plentiful there. IPM can deliver a systems approach to farming, can really address a whole bunch of different resource concerns. So what I would like to see IPM people do is look at ways to integrate IPM into water conservation, into water quality, into soil, plant, to this whole swath of things. Really look at IPM and how it can be integrated into those programs. It'll be to the long-term benefit of IPM, it'll be the long-term benefit of resource conservation, and the long run, it will increase the likelihood that farmers will use these programs. So with that, thank you very much. Any questions?
Any questions for Larry or?
Oh, Dave? God, Dave.
Larry, as university researcher, we use all of, and we do not.
Yeah.
You know, we do a lot of the TAR, the RAND grants, all that sort of stuff. That's been great because basically they put their money where our mouth is. We come up with cost share and, you know, reduce risk, pesticides, and cost estimate. The disconnect has been when you try to measure the universities that,
isn't doing a better job. Now, they're talking about how you take the indicators or the results from the implementation of an IPM program and integrate those results into the way NRCS looks at the results from its incentive payments under EQIP or other programs. Quite frankly, if it's going to work, the expertise is entirely on the university and extension side. So I think the trick in all of that is for you to decide what's meaningful in terms of real results and make them simple and meaningful. Meaningful, I think meaningful to the grower, meaningful from a scientific point of view, and then sit down with NRCS and say, okay, here's what we know about this. How can we take what you know is being implemented in these contracts and track that from what we know about what the impacts are, whether it's change in pesticide use, increases in predator species, things like that. I think for the moment the burden's on the land grants to come up with something that works and then figure out how to integrate that into NRCS. That doesn't mean you can't go to NRCS for money to do that, because I think it'd be a worthwhile thing. But I think that's the right cycle of events.
Was there another question?
Yeah, Barry.
I've asked you this privately, and I know Bob funds large-scale implementation programs and that sort of thing. But the equipment is individual growers, individual farms. I think that other people like Carolyn Pinkham was here a minute ago and would be able to have a group of growers on a wider scale, and I think that that would be beneficial. What do you think?
Well, I would be beneficial, and if I understand correctly, and I'm not going to quote Mark on this, I know of parts of the country where it's possible to look at growers if it's a contiguous area, to look at those contracts all together and rank them as a group of contracts, and that way you can actually have a contiguous implementation. I know that's possible. I don't know what the mechanisms are for doing it, but the program is set up so that can be done. I think to make it happen, you'd have to have a pretty clear idea of what you wanted to do, and you and I talked about some of the insect problems that would fit that scenario. If you had a clear idea of what you're going to do, if it fit within county priorities, I think it could, and all of the growers had applications that were equally fundable. I mean, they weren't like, finding highly erodible land or something like that. I think that could work. I really do. I mean, it's easy for me to say because I'm going to go back home to North Carolina, but I think it should work. Unless Mark wants to say, no, it wouldn't, in which case I wouldn't think it would.
I was speaking with Lawrence Clark on this very topic. He's Lawrence Clark, retired now in NRCS. There's the chief. He's one of the associate chiefs. And I referred to this exact same thing. He said, oh, that's group planning. That's permissible. In fact, we used to do a lot of that a couple of decades ago. We need to get back to doing more of that.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It makes sense in engaging in many of our communities who want
to
do it.
To make that happen, I think it'd be nice to have some money for you and a set of people to work on putting that together, because I think there are two things you'd want to do. One is to make it work, and it would take some time. The other is, it'd be really nice to document how you did that so that either other commodity groups or people in other states could see it. So they could say, one of the advantages we have, and I'll talk about it a little bit more, is working with lots of different states. We'll find something that works in one state because of what they're doing and be able to apply it and work in another state. And it's always easier, as much as I might think of myself, if I'm talking to somebody in NRCS, I say, I think this is a good idea. They go, yeah, okay, fine. And I say, somebody in another state has done this, and it actually worked. They go, oh, okay, give me the phone number. You know, so.
Thank you, Larry.